Damn it.
Yeah, I'll give you $50 if you can work
it. All right. Here we go. Exodus chapter 20. We're going to, this is basically the Ten Commandments part two. Last week, you know, we dealt with a lot of the aspects of the Ten Commandments that, you know, you normally typically don't hear. And now we're going to get into the first half of the commandments themselves. Okay, so we're probably going to get through the first four commandments today, I think. And then next week we'll get through the remainder of the commandments. But before we start, here's what I want to do. I'm going to read you Paul's statement about the law and its relationship to the Christian from Romans chapter 7, you know, beginning in verse 1. And I just want you to think about it. Let me read it, and then let's just take a little bit of reaction from the floor about what Paul is talking about here. And then, you know, I'm gonna walk you through, you know, what we're gonna study today, and then we're going to see if maybe your mind has changed as far as what you just heard Paul say from Romans chapter 7. Okay, and if you do any study at all, you'll hear commentators, you know, very well-respected, highly developed commentary that says things like, okay, we're no longer under the law, you know, because of what Christ did, his finished work on the cross, we're no longer under the law. And No, I'm not going to say that because I want you to tell me what this says to you. Okay, so here it is. Romans, we're going to begin with Romans chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. Or do you not know, brothers, and this is Paul talking to Christians, okay? I mean, every single one of Paul's letters is written to Christians, okay? It has nothing to do with an evangelistic structure of to the lost world. Everything that Paul wrote was to you, the Christian, who already believes, who already has loyal love for Jesus Christ, who is already saved and sealed until the day of redemption, okay? He's not trying to convince you that Jesus is the Messiah. What he's trying to do is, you know, encourage you to live a life worthy of that standing that you already have. Okay, and so, or do you not know, brothers, for I am speaking to those who know the law, that the law is binding on a person only as long as he lives. And then he gives this marriage talk. He says, you know, the law in relationship to the believer is sort of like the marriage covenant is to a woman whose husband is alive, okay? And so here's what he says. For a married woman is bound by law to her husband while he lives. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law of marriage. Now that's a dangerous preposition when it comes to just marriage in general, because she knows if I put a pillow over his face while he's sleeping, I'm out. Okay? So there you go.
Sheila, take note.
Yeah, take note. Accordingly, she will be called an adulteress if she lives with another man while her husband is alive. But if her husband dies, she is free from the law. And if she marries another man, she is not an adulteress. Okay, so there it is. He's just laying it out. You know, this is the Jewish law. Likewise, my brothers, you also have died to the law through the body of Christ, so that you may belong to another, to him who has been raised from the dead, in order that we may bear fruit for God. For while we were living in the flesh, our sinful passions, aroused by the law, were at work in our members to bear fruit for death. But now we are released from the law, having died to that which held us captive, so that we serve in the new way of the Spirit and not in the old way of the written code. Now, Now that you've heard that, let's just talk about, you know, what's that saying to you? What are some of the things that makes you, how that makes you feel?
Free.
Okay. Free. There's a freedom. Okay. So in other words, somehow this law was binding us. You know, we were kind of like slaves to it, but now all of a sudden, kaboom, we've escaped from it, you know.
The Ten Commandments.
Okay.
The penalty.
Well, yeah.
The penalty.
I mean, the law, yeah, has everything to do with the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, and everything else that goes along with it. But yeah,
so
absolutely.
We're not under that anymore.
Mm hmm.
From okay. grace.
Okay, so there you go. Now, that's a very common conception.
Is that
in
my
church.
Catechism?
That's you, definitely your catechism. I'm no longer under the law, but I'm under grace. So grace has completely abolished the law. So now I can murder anyone that I want. I can lie anytime that I want. I can covet anything because I'm not under the law anymore. I'm under grace.
But I don't believe that part.
Okay,
yeah.
There you go.
Foolish Galatians.
There you go.
Huh?
Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, immediately if I say it that way, then you have to come back and say, well, that's not what I believe. Okay.
Well, I believe it's that you're free from the penalty. If you were to break the law.
Okay. Okay.
And you're free from, because of grace.
Uh-huh.
Christ will take that.
Okay, so that anyone before the cross, anyone who broke the law then is completely condemned.
I see where you're going.
Okay, everybody has to say, no. Right? But, I mean, these are the statements that come out that lead us in the wrong direction.
Right.
Okay.
Well, also, I just wanted to bring up that for him saying this too, and all the man-made laws that
mm-hmm.
the Jewish Pharisees or whatever had made along the way,
mm-hmm.
so that you weren't trapped, I guess, as much, or that feeling that, aside from the Ten Commandments, that we're not God's kids.
Yeah, so what Terry is talking about is the fact that, you know, as we read the New Testament and we look particularly at the Pharisees, they had added to the law, you know, different stipulations so that when they decided that they were going to keep the law, then, you know, by not walking any more than 20 paces from their front door, things like that, not dragging their walking stick as their walking along on the Sabbath because that's furrowing the ground and that's work. Those kinds of things. That's what she's speaking of. Okay. So that they were being saved by that. Now, see, here's the problem with that. And unfortunately, you hear that and it's taught to you too often, especially in America. Because think about this. The Pharisees in the New Testament were living in Jerusalem. Okay? They were living in Jerusalem. In other words, they were in the Promised Land. Okay? Now, why would they not be living in the Promised Land? Why would they not? I mean, let's and think, you know, put on your Jewish cap here for a minute and think back toward the patriarchs and think about, you know, what happened to the people? Why aren't all 12 tribes in the New Testament living in Jerusalem? How come that's the case? What was it that a Pharisee would have said, this is the worst thing that can happen to me? What would that have been? How would they have felt? This is the worst thing that could happen to me, and this is the reason why I'm keeping the law. Had nothing to do with salvation. Had everything to do with exile.
They didn't want to be exiled?
Yes, absolutely. They didn't want to lose the land. They didn't want... Every time that they didn't keep the law, God said, that's it. You can't stay in the Promised Land. You're still my people. But you can't have the land. You can't stay in the Promised Land. That's the reason why. Every Pharisee in the New Testament was keeping the law so that he didn't get exiled. That's the worst thing that could happen to them. And what were they looking forward to as far as the messianic coming was concerned? That they that the Messiah would get rid of the oppressors that were in the land. Okay?
Yes.
It was all about the land. Ha'aretz. If you go over to Jerusalem and you buy a newspaper, the name of the newspaper is Ha'aretz. That is the land. It's the land. It's all about the land. You know, I mean,
territory.
The Pharisees were not working to gain the favor of God. The Pharisees were working hard so they didn't get exiled. See, the Pharisees never thought that they were keeping the law in order to be saved, in order to have eternal life. They never thought about that. As a matter of fact, they asked Jesus over and over again. One of the most pointed questions that Jesus got asked by a group of Pharisees and scribes and lawkeepers, what do I have to do to gain eternal life? And they wouldn't have asked that question if they were keeping the law and they thought that was what they were doing. Why would they ask that question? No, they were keeping the law so they wouldn't get exiled. That's why. Okay. And so, you know, you sitting here in 21st century America saying, okay, we're not like those guys condemned under the law. Because you're thinking salvation. They're not even thinking about salvation. And Paul's not thinking about salvation. Okay? All right.
Paul's not thinking about salvation in this passage.
No, he's not.
He's just thinking about the land.
He is thinking about the land. And as we go through, we'll come back to it and we'll see, okay. Now, how do we feel, Paul's, what Paul's saying here?
Okay, but is he saying this so that it's relatable because this is how they think, you know what I'm saying? That
Paul knows exactly how they think.
Right, so he speaks that way to them, referring, using that as a reference so that they can grasp the understanding to some degree? Or
they had perfect understanding.
About salvation, though, regarding the salvation.
They understood. They understood they were God's people. They understood that they were chosen.
Do they think they're already, because just by the fact that God chose them, do they think they're already saved? And so the only thing that they need to worry about is being exiled then through disobedience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what they were worried about.
Question.
They were worried about losing the land.
They don't have a question about salvation because they believe they're saved already.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they they wanted to hear from Jesus himself. The Pharisees had no concept of keeping the law so that they could remain God's people. They had every concept of keeping the law so that they could remain in the land and not be exiled. That's what they're thinking.
Right. Well, that's their history.
Of course it's their history. Mm-hmm. Right. So, with that, let's go ahead and look at Exodus chapter 20. Anybody else have any questions before we move on? I know you're going to have a lot, but the point is we're going to address it again once we go through this.
But I mean, predominantly, isn't he just talking about we no longer are burdened by the law because we've been gifted this Holy Spirit, and now we get to look to the kingdom, we get to look to that lives in us rather than just being bound by the law and oppressed and worried about that every day. You just look at what you rely on the Holy Spirit that dwells in you to do the right thing, kind of.
Okay, that's a perfect segue. So Michelle just said, isn't he just saying that don't worry about the burden of the law, because now Christ has, in his finished work on the cross, has given us grace, and now we're not looking at the law anymore, you know. But I like the way she said it, because that adds gasoline to my fire, the burden of the law. Okay, so there you go. All right. So now let's jump into it here, and let's Let's figure out what the Apostle Paul is trying to tell us in Romans chapter 7. All right? That's the way I want to pursue this.
Okay.
Because I think it's important for us, in order to understand this, it's important for us to know that. So, now, again, we talked last week about the fact that, if you ask a Jewish rabbi about the 10 words, okay, and if you don't get what I'm saying there, go back last week and listen to it. If you ask a Jewish rabbi about the 10 words, he will say that verse 2 is the first of the 10 words, that I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And then if you ask a Jewish rabbi, what about the 10 commandments? He'll say, well, that's not one of them because it's not an imperative. But you shall have no other gods before me is the first one. You shall not make for yourself a carved image. That's the second one. You shall not make any image of anything, likeness, heaven above or earth beneath. That's the second one. And then you shall not bow down to them. That's the third one. Because, see, those are all imperative statements. Those are commands, okay? So he looks at words and commands as two very different things. And we just think about it as Americans, as because we've been taught these are the Ten Commandments. You know, and they've been sliced and diced for us over the centuries. And you know, some of us believe commandment 1 through 10 are one thing, and some of us believe commandment 1 through 10 are another thing. Okay, but the point is here, we're going to go through these, and you know, that those are semantics, and I'm not really worried about those. So we're going to just address them the way that you're used to them being addressed today, because that's kind of immaterial. But no matter what, you know, as we look at these things, a Jew is going to say, if you don't believe that, nothing else matters. We can just stop right here. If you don't believe that I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, if you don't believe that God is above all the other gods that we've just experienced in Egypt, if you don't believe that, there's no place else to go. You know, if you don't believe that God is bigger and stronger, if you don't believe that he's completely unique and different from the other gods, oh, and by the way, you know, when you read God said, you shall have no other gods before me, what is that? What is God saying there? What's the implication of God saying, you shall have no other gods before me? There you go. That there are other gods.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
If gold, money, stuff like that.
That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. There are other gods. There are actually other gods. Why? I mean, you know, if God said, you know, I'm stronger than Mickey Mouse. I'm stronger than Spider-Man. If he's saying those kinds of things, that's hollow. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. They don't exist. So how can you compare yourself to something that's just a fantasy?
So it's the unseen realm.
Of course. Of course. They are the god. We're still talking about the gods of Egypt here.
Oh, okay. I gotcha.
Okay.
Yeah.
We still are. And remember, you know, remember the story, okay? Remember the story. Don't divorce these verses from the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm.
You can't even divorce these verses from, you know, we should have started this story in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, okay? We can't divorce them from that either. Remember, okay, so let's take a little journey. Remember where we've come from. All right, so, you know, we've had the fall. All those problems and issues. We've had the fall in Genesis chapter 3, the fall in Genesis chapter 6, the fall in Genesis chapter 10, okay? And so, you know, we look at Adam and Eve, okay? And God's relationship with them, and it got broken, okay? And not only that, but even the angels themselves, you know, stepped out of their proper domain and caused even further damage. And there was a reset. And it was Noah and his righteous family that got off the ark. But yet, you know, that reset didn't work. You know, now we're right back and at the Tower of Babel. It's just as bad as it ever was. And then, you know, there was actually another reset when God divorced all the nations, when he put them underneath the auspice of all the other gods. And in a very real way, if you talk to most scholars and you say that Abraham and Sarah are the new Adam and Eve, they would agree with you because they are. Abraham and Sarah called out of the nations, okay, to start a new people of God. And there were covenants that happened, you know, all the way through that. The Noetic covenant, you know, I'm not going to destroy the earth like that anymore. I'm going to put the bow in the sky, and that's going to be the sign of the covenant to Noah. And then as he brought Abram out of the nations, you know, he made a covenant with him. And he said that, you know, there's going to be, you know, a Messiah rise up from this multitude that's going to happen because I'm bringing you and Sarah out of the nations. And miraculously, because Sarah was barren, miraculously, you know, they became a great nation. And that's the great nation that came out of Egypt in the Exodus that we just read about. But all the way through there was always a sign. There was always a sign. With Noah, it was the bow in the sky. Okay? With Abraham, it was circumcision. Okay? And now at Sinai, it's the law. Okay? And now for you and me, after the cross, it's Christ the Messiah. Okay? And so, what I'm proposing as we go through these laws, the people at Sinai should have felt about the law exactly the same way that we feel about Christ the Messiah today, that Abraham would have felt about circumcision, that Noah would have felt about the bow in the sky when he saw it. You know, there's this covenant, and the covenant always comes with signs, reminders. This is who you are. You're my people. Okay? It's a love letter written. I mean, and again, what would it have been? What would it have been if Noah would have said, I'm not going to pay any attention to that stupid rainbow. That means nothing to me. What would it have been if Abraham would have said, I'm not doing that circumcision stuff. You know, that's going to hurt. I'm not going to do that. You know? And again, what would have been if the people of Sinai would have said, that law, you know, I don't want to do that. I want to live the way I want to live. You know? What would it have been? And today, if we, you know, I don't care what Christ did on the cross. You know, I don't care about any of that stuff. Think about what the story says. Think about where we are in the story and what we've already been exposed to. All those covenants and all those signs and what they're there for. Okay? That has everything to do with what we're looking at here at Sinai. Everything. It has everything to do with that. Okay. So now we do believe that God is the God Most High, that He's above all other gods, that He is the only one who is omnipotent, omnificent, that He's the only one who has created anything. Everything else has been created. Only God is creator. That, you know, only it's only Him who has a strong enough right arm to thwart any other power that a God, a created God, has. It's only Him. He is species unique. There is none like Him. None. God is an Elohim, and all the other gods are Elohim, but there are no Elohims like God, Most High. Okay? That's the picture that we're painting here. And if we don't keep this in our minds as we read the Ten Commandments, it becomes a list of do's and don'ts. Okay? And it's not a list of do's and don'ts. It's just a it's just as much a sign as the cross is a sign for us today. It's just as much a sign. It's simply a sign. That's what it is. So here we go. Let's talk about this. The first thing we see is, you shall have no other gods before me. And we made the comment already that, you know, indeed this says that there are other gods. Okay, so if you want to take the supernatural out of the Bible, you're going to have to cut out a whole bunch of verses. Because, you know, this assumes that you understand, yep, there are plenty of other gods. And that's just the way it is. And so, you know, as we look at this, this is going to be a sign, okay, that I'm not going to put any other god above my God. Okay, this is a sign. A sign of what? Well, it's simple, of loyal belief. That's what it's a sign of. It's loyal belief. You know, who's your king? Exactly. So, you know, when in Genesis it says of Abraham that he believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness, and Paul, you know, quotes that again in Romans, when it says that, we're talking about loyal love that Abram has for his God. You know, we're talking about the type of love, the type of faith that's loyal to the point that it's credited to him as righteousness. And we're not talking about the fact that Abraham is keeping any part of the law, because the law wasn't even there then, okay? We didn't get the law until we're here, okay? That's back in Genesis. And so what we're looking at here is loyal love. And a sign of that loyal love is that you won't have any other gods. The word there in Hebrew is panei, before my nose, before my face. Okay? So any other god is at my feet, you know. And that's how you believe. Let's put it this way. The law has everything to do with the word behave, not believe. Okay, you already believe, so therefore you're behaving this way. Mm. Behaving this way is automatic because you have this loyal love and belief. Okay, are you going to do it perfectly? Absolutely not. No possible way. And we'll get into that too. But too often, our ideas of the law are meritorious toward God. And when I say that, what I mean is, you really do believe that if you break the law, God will hate you, okay? And that you'll lose any status and standing before God if that's the case. In other words, you know, you're living out your relationship with God, behaving yourself to a point that, you know, you're staying in favor, and so that means you can live with him. And if you ever stop doing those things, you're not going to be able to live with them. Okay? And that's how the people were living under the gods of Egypt. Because that's how they were. Mm-hmm. You know, the gods of Egypt demanded a certain type of behavior in order to stay in favor. Okay? And so when we go through this and when we look at it, I want you to remember that as God's people come out of Egypt, not only Hebrews came out of Egypt, but also other Egyptians. Okay? Why? Because there's people looking over the fence. Now this sounds a little bit creepy in Arizona in 21st century America, but imagine your next door neighbor looking over your fence, okay? Just standing there looking over your fence, watching your life, okay? How is it going to affect him as he looks over your fence and he watches your life, okay? Think about that for a minute, and because that's exactly what we're talking about here. So, now, you're not going to have any other gods before my face. In other words, you're not going to put any god at my level. Everything is below me. Everything is below me. Everything has been created by me. I'm completely unique in every way. And so, you know, with that, we say that, you know, one of the points here is, remember the Exodus story, Pharaoh said, or has already said mockingly, who is Yahweh that I should listen to him? Who is he that I should listen to him? Listen to Exodus 6:7. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from underneath the burdens of the Egyptians. Okay? Remember, Pharaoh's saying, who's Yahweh anyway? Okay? Exodus 7:5. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt to bring out the people of Israel from among them. Why is God doing this? So that the people of Egypt will know that I am God and there's no one like me. So, you know, the Egyptians are going to learn the lesson that their gods are lesser, and that Israel is going to learn the lesson that they're going to believe that their God, the God Most High, is the God of all gods. Exodus 8:10, Moses said to Pharaoh, be pleased to command me when I am to plead for you and your servants, for the people, that the frogs be cut off from you and that your houses be left only in the Nile. And so, in other words, the frogs are going to be left only in the Nile. And Pharaoh said to Moses, Pharaoh said, you know, tomorrow, I want this to happen right away. And Moses said, be it as you say, so that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. Okay, remember those things that have been said so far. You know, that's the whole point. And then Exodus 14, the Red Sea crossing, God says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And then in verse 18, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. This is the things that we've been reading, you know. And as a Yahweh follower, these are the things that we're seeing. And we know in our heart that Yahweh is the God Most High, that there's no one like him at all, none like him at all. And so this is how the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, begins, you know. Do you know now, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Now because of that, because you know that and you believe it, you know, verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. Okay? It's not like you could sit there and be an Israelite and believe that in no deity or that, you know, God's nothing special. You know, you can't do that. You just can't do it. How could you do that after you've been through all this, you've seen all this? How could you just say, well, you know, yeah, God's pretty tough, but, you know, I think, you know, if the other gods really worked hard and worked out a little bit, maybe they would do better next time. You know? That's not how you would think. You know, that's just not how you would think. And so, you know, That's really what we're looking at here. And so, as the Egyptians looked over the fence and saw these Yahweh followers, there was something attractive enough that they left town with them. And as they left town and they gained numbers, in other words, this rabble came out with them. Okay, all these pagan Egyptians are saying, "Hey, I'm with these guys. I've lived on this side of the fence, and I've looked over that side of the fence, and I like what I see over there, and I'm gone. I'm going with them. If they leave, I leave." And they're going to be walking past all of these nations, and people are going to be committing themselves exactly the same way. As the nation moved past nations, they gained and they gained and they gained. And anybody who said, "That's the God Most High, those are the people I want to be with," they were welcome. All the way up to Rahab and all her family at the walls of Jericho. You know, it was people looking over the fence, looking at God's people. So, what I'm going to propose to you, that the Old Testament is far more evangelizing than the New. Way more. In other words, you know, most of the time we say, well, you know, we're not called to be evangelists until Jesus makes the Great Commission at the end of his life. Not so at all. And so if we look at the commentary to this little section right here, we find it in Deuteronomy chapter 4. And, I would love to read it all, but I can't. but I'm going to pick up in verse 7 here, because this asks a question. This asks a question that points us to the answer, what's the law? Okay? This answers the question. "For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules," oh, you guessed it, the law, "that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that is set before you today? Only take care and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life." Okay. Now, not only that, but they thought this was so important that this statement was made: "Make them known to your children and your children's children, how on the day that they stood before the Lord your God at Horeb," that's Mount Sinai, "the Lord said to me, 'Gather the people to me, that I may let them hear my words, so that they may learn to fear me all the days that they have to live on earth, that they may teach their children so.' And you came near and stood at the foot of the mountain while the mountain burned with fire, to the heart of heaven, wrapped in darkness, cloud, and gloom. And the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of words." Okay, there's the words. "But saw no form. There was only a voice." It goes on and talking about these statutes and rules. But the question is the answer. The question is, what nation has a law so beautiful and righteous as this? And I can tell you, if you, and you know, we may, as a group, we may very well go over to Israel someday soon. And here's what you're going to see when you go over there. There's going to be a lot of roads that intersect the nation of Israel from other people groups that are over there, you know, particularly the Palestinians, okay? And you're going to be driving down these roads, and as you look over on the right side of the road where the Hebrews live, it's going to look like a garden. It's going to look like a well-cared-for garden. Things are going to be in order. No trash in place. Birds are chirping. You know, fruit is budding. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to look at. And on the other side, as you turn your head, swerve your head over to the other side and look out the bus window on the other side, to the Palestinian side, you're going to see a trash dump.
Chaos.
Complete chaos. You know, you're going to see bags of trash piled up to the windowsills because all they do is just chuck their trash right out the window. Who knows when someone comes to gather, pick it up. Nothing's growing. It's desert. It's scruff. You know, it looks like the high desert here around the valley. I mean, it's ugly, you know. And you know why? Because it's all about the law. You know, it's all about the law. It's all about how the people are behaving, you know, because of what the loyal love that they have. Terry.
God also, he promised that there would be, for Israel, that it would be green.
Hmm?
That he, you know, there in the desert, that there would be water and that it would be abundant.
It's exactly as he promised.
Mm-hmm.
Because why? The people have loyal love. You know, they're doing exactly what they're supposed to do.
Right. You know what? They're the ones, I think, who invented the drip system.
Oh, yeah. No. There's more engineers per capita in Israel than there is anywhere else on earth. Yeah. But, okay. Susan. Yeah, there's.
So
Sheila's got some pictures to.
So, is the Ten Commandments then more like a description of what loyal love looks like?
Yes, it is. Exactly right.
Well, I'm sorry.
It's exactly what it is. And not only that, but it's not a burden.
Right. So that's why you teach it to your kids. This is what loyal love looks like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. This is what it looks like.
Yeah.
This is what being in God's family produces.
This
you know?
Hebrews.
Okay.
So. All I said, Sharon, was 10 commandments are what loyal love looks like. Thank you.
Yeah, let's go back then to the 10 commandments. And, you know, let's take a look at a little bit more of what God is talking about and remember where they came from and what they've experienced. Because when we were talking about the plague, Sheila was running, you know, the PowerPoint slide and we were showing you pictures of the gods of Egypt. Okay, you remember that?
Ra,
Horus, the frog gods, all those gods of Egypt. Because each one of the 10 plagues was an attack on one of those gods, okay? And all of them, there were images of all of them, okay? And the images were a combination of a human body with an animal-like head, almost always an animal-like head, whether it was a frog or a raven or some sort type of bird, you know, There was always those images. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above. Why? Why would that be? Well, okay, there's a lot of reasons why. But first of all, God, we've already said that God's unique. And that's what verse 2 is all about. And that he's not created. Okay? And we've already seen that, you know, in Deuteronomy chapter 4, that, you know, we heard the voice, but we couldn't see an image. We couldn't see, you know, any image. There was no body there. We just saw a voice. You know, there's no possible way to take anything that was created and make an image that's flattering in any way to the imageless God, the Creator God. And so, as we look over the fence and we look at God's people, what we won't see, what will be conspicuously absent, is any of the statues that I've had to worship. Okay? And remember, you know, we know for sure that even the gods of Egypt, if the gods would have come in person to the people of Egypt, it would have been hard for the people to relate. Because, you know, any time a god stands before a human being, they're on their face. They take their breath away. You know, John, the Revelator in Revelation, starts to worship this angel that's talking to him about what's unfolding. He said, don't worship me, okay? you can't stand in the presence of glory like that. You can't relate. And that's the reason why they made the statues, okay, so that they could channel the God and so that they could communicate. There was a channel, okay, that's channeling a God so that you can talk. That's the reason why the statues talk, okay. But guess what? You're looking over the fence and you're looking for these statues and there aren't any. You're looking over the fence and what you see is a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. And you're saying, oh my goodness, their God is actually with them in there. He's actually there. It's not statues and carvings. He's actually there. So when you're looking over that fence, it's like, I like that over there. See, all of these things are evangelistic in nature. They're evangelistic. And not only that, but they're not only are they not a burden, it's like saying, which side of the road over in Israel do you want to live on? Do you want to live over here where it's a garden? Or do you want to live over here where it literally looks like a landfill? Where I know there's rats. You know, that's the point. That's the whole point of the Ten Commandments. The people are going to be looking over the fence, and they're going to be seeing what they're seeing based on the fact that the people are, you know, they're believing, they're living, and they're living in abundance under these statutes, under these laws. It's not a burden at all. What? It's a sign. That's what it is. It's a sign. Okay, and so it says that, you know, in heaven above or earth beneath or the water under the earth, those are the three planes of existence that a Hebrew person would have. That's how they saw the universe. It's heaven, earth, and under the earth. And so, you know, that's the reason why God's talking that way, because that he's saying, don't look anywhere in creation to try to find an image for me. It can't be done, and it would be wrong. You shall not, and here's the main thing, you shall not bow down to them and serve them, okay? Because as you're looking at the Egyptians, that's exactly what they're doing. They're bowing down to their gods, and they're serving them. Now you might say, well, okay, what's the big deal? Well, again, If you serve those gods are demanding that you live a certain way in order to stay in a meritorious position with that god, okay? And in order to do that, you had better be the richest, and you had better be the type of person that will do anything that they tell you to. Okay. You better be willing to lie. You better be willing to steal. And certainly you're going to covet, because anyone who has anything that would increase your status before me, you need to desire that. So as you look over that side of the fence, that's how those people are living, because that's how those gods allow you to flourish. And if you want to know why the world works the way it does, if you want to know why it's so crazy to watch the politics that's going on in the United States today, is because even though those gods have been bound by Jesus and his finished work on the cross, the remnants of what they created is still alive and well. And so you must, in order to keep the status on the wrong side of the fence, you must steal. You must murder. You've got to kill everybody that doesn't think like you. You have to take anything that you can, because there's scarcity on this side. There's not abundance. If you don't steal everything you can get your hands on, someday you're going to find yourself hungry and on the outside looking in. But guess what? On this side of the fence, there's complete abundance. There's a God who's actively working and here. And if the people need food, it rains down from heaven. If the people need water, it bursts out of rocks. the Ten Commandments are completely evangelistic in nature. Completely evangelistic in nature. All right. So, we're here and we see that, you know, we're not to bow down to them, for I am the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Now, this is a very interesting thing because this word jealous, you know, we can look at this word and we know as human beings, we know what it is to be jealous. But this word actually really just means that you're turning red. Okay, because, you know, when you're jealous, you have this flushness that comes over you. You know, that's, you know, this anger, redness in the face, that's the kind of thing. But this word is only related to God in all of the Bible. It is never said of a human being. Okay, never said of a human being. So again, in as far as we're concerned, you know, what would it be if you say, well, you know, I really don't care where my spouse is or who they're with. You know, yeah, they'll come home as long as they paid the bills and, you know, I don't care. What do I care? You know, so what? You know, that's living as if, you know, there's no value there. It's just there's no value at all. What would it be if God would say, well, you know, I don't care if they worship those other gods for a while. What do I care? You know? Yeah, it's going to kill them. But what do I care?
He loves
us. Yeah, and that's the reason why he's jealous. You know, that's the reason why he won't have any other gods before his face, and he won't have us interacting with those gods, you know? Because he's a jealous God. Now, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. All right, so now right there, right there, so many people will read this Hebrew idiom and they'll say, oh, well, see, you know, my father was indicted and is still in prison today. For, you know, what you name it, whatever felony he created. So therefore, you know, God not only hates him, but God hates me too. Because, you know, you're actually feeling the consequences of that. There are consequences to sin. And there's no doubt that, you know, your family name has been tarnished for sure. And yeah, you're going to feel those consequences. But so often, you know, you'll hear stories, and especially in some of what we call the third world countries, missionaries will go in there and they'll preach the gospel. They'll tell people about Jesus Christ, and they'll be absolutely elated, but at the same time, completely downcast because they'll say, the witch doctor prescribed a curse upon my family 2 years ago, and that includes me. So there's no possible way that God will take me. I've been cursed. Okay. And people will look at verses like this and say, look, yeah, see, it's really true. Because God's going to visit iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. What that really is saying is, that's a Hebrew idiom that says that God's wrath is a very short thing. Okay. Because a Hebrew can look at the third and fourth generation, and that's just one lifetime. Because Hebrews, you know, especially that this time, live long enough to see your great-grandchildren. But they also know that life is short. We're just here. It's a vapor. And this is a Hebrew idiom that says God's wrath is short. It's there. Anyone who hates him. But, you know, if you look at the book of Ezekiel, if you look at the book of Jeremiah, you'll see this idiom that says, you know, the fathers ate sour grapes and the children's teeth are still on edge. Okay? And Jesus taught against this, and so did Ezekiel and Jeremiah, saying that, no, you know, everyone stands before God and pays the penalty for rejecting him, and it's on them solely alone. It doesn't make any difference whether your father did it or not. It makes every difference whether you've done it or not. That's the point. It's a personal thing, personal individual thing. And so, you know, this thought, this idiom was there, and it's still here in the world today. These third world folks that really truly believe that they're under a curse know that they're unredeemable. Not because of anything they've done, just because their grandfather got a curse from a witch doctor. Okay. But what this is saying is, you know, God's wrath is short, but thousands of generations, no one can fathom that. God's love is infinite. Infinite. That's what it's saying. This is a Hebrew idiom. And that's what it's all about. You know, don't think that there's this generational curse because of verses like this and other idioms that are in Scripture that, you know, basically write you off. It's not true. And don't think that just because, you know, your father is completely evil, don't think that, you know, you're bound for the same kind of life. It's not true. It's a lie. Stop believing that lie. And you know, so we're dealing with the fact here that this is who I am. There's a loyal type of faith. There's a loyal type of love for me that always has me in that position and everyone else at my feet. And when that happens, then what you'll see is you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. All right. If we're living on the other side of the fence with the Egyptian gods, and the Egyptian gods have just run me through the ringer, okay? I've had to lie all day long, cheat, steal, to try to get what I need so that they'll be happy with me. When I come home at night, I'm going to just sit there and just say, man, that Baal, what a rotten, no good for nothing. Do you know what he had me doing today? You know, they're just going to dress him down, right? On the other side of the fence, you never see that. Because God doesn't demand those kinds of things. God doesn't require you to do those types of things. If you're sitting there and you're degrading the name that's above all names because of the things that you had to do and you're upset with him and you're calling him names, that's completely out of step with what's actually happening. God is not going to hold you guiltless if that's who you are. If that's who you are, I know for sure that you don't believe that I'm the God Most High. I know for sure that that's the case. And, you know, it's interesting because this is one of the laws that has the typical person practicing Judaism forbidding themselves for even speaking the word Yahweh. You know, as they read the Old Testament, they'll read Adonai. You know, they'll take the Aramaic. Actually, it's a cross actually between Yahweh and the Aramaic for Yahweh, and they put the wrong vowels in the wrong place. Comes out Adonai. But the point is, they won't speak it because they're just living this superstition. Well, if I never speak the name of God, then I can't break this commandment. Okay? And of course, that has nothing to do with the commandment itself. You know, you are taking the Lord's name in vain anytime you put the t-shirt on that says, I'm a Yahweh follower, and then dress him down. That's what it is. That's what it is to take his name in vain. And yeah, there's no question that you should never use it flippantly. No doubt about that. You know, you should never use the name of God flippantly. That's a bad thing. That is walking on thin ice. Always walking on thin ice. But, you know, you want to put the t-shirt on and then live like he's not the God Most High that just delivered you out of Egypt. That's taking his name in vain. All right, so we're a long way into it, so we're going to stop right there for now. We'll pick up, you know, I would have liked to have gotten to the Sabbath because that's a section that basically has everything to do with how you relate to God. And then the rest, the fifth commandment is a transition between God and other people. It's a transition, and then all the rest, the other five, are completely, you know, this is who God is in my life. This is how I treat the people that are around me, you know. But again, what I want you to understand is when people look over the fence and they look at God's people and they're doing the law, when they're following the law, they're looking saying, man, I wish my marriage looked like that. I wish my kids acted like that. I wish my house and my lawn looked like that. It's all evangelistic. That's what it's all about. It's about allowing the rest of the world who's under the auspice of the other gods and all of their demands. And not only do they not live with them, but they live up on a mountain in paradise while, you know, they let their people just live in squalor. But they don't care. They know their people are noisy, they stink, and they cause lots of problems. So I'm not going to live with them. But the people are looking over there, and God is in the camp. It's an amazing difference. And I want to be on that side of the fence. When I look over, I want to be on that side of the fence. All right, so then we come back to Romans chapter 7. Okay. And we look, and what Paul is saying is, you remember that the beauty of the law? And it's signed to us. It's now been replaced with looking at Jesus Christ. He is now what we look to. Okay, not the law anymore. We look to Jesus Christ. He's the new sign. And as we look to him, he is the perfection of the law. And Jesus himself said, you know, what's the summation of the law? Love God with absolutely everything that you are and love everybody else exactly the same way, the best that you can. And so, what are we talking about here? We are talking about living a life. And I've just got to say it this way. I have no better way to say it. If we will follow the law 60% of the time, we will look so attractive to the outside world that there's no way we'll ever have to go out and say, let me tell you about Jesus, because they're going to be knocking on our door. And that's the way it's actually supposed to be. Because, and we'll talk about this next week. I'll steal a little bit of my own thunder here. When Jesus was giving us the Great Commission, and, you know, our English translations say, go and make disciples of all nations, that Greek word really does mean live. Live to make disciples of all nations. And that's what the law is all about. It's a beautiful thing. It's not burdensome. It's gorgeous. And it makes a paradise everywhere it resides. Okay, so we'll talk about the rest of the law and its uniqueness next week, and then we'll be done. All right, so that's the end of this lesson.